is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, some compelling information has been coming out in recent weeks in the increasing cost of healthcare in the country, especially when it comes to insurance coverage.
After several years of historically low increases in health insurance costs for consumers, the rates for 2017 are out, and some insurance consumers are going to see 25% increases in premiums for next year, something I think we all, including the president, were hoping to avoid.
Analysts have pointed to insurers setting rates during the first few open enrollments that were based on speculation that there would be more participation from young people. Rates have been readjusted for the next year to reflect the higher proportion of older, sicker participants and the lack of competition in certain marketplaces, as many large insurers have also pulled out of the exchange.
And employer-based insurance is demanding more out-of-pocket costs than ever before for consumers who get coverage through their employers. Everywhere, consumers seem to be paying more in out-of-pocket costs.
Mm-hmm. And as we look at the rising cost of care, a growing number of entities are promoting more cost awareness in care delivery.
And that is something that our guest today is very focused on. Dr. Neil Shah is founder of Costs of Care, a global organization that's aimed at promoting value-based care in medical training. How can we deliver high-quality care that also reflects value for the patients as well as the healthcare industry?
Looking forward to this conversation, and also looking forward to Laurie Robertson, managing editor of FatCheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we love to hear from you.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hara, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hara with these healthcare headlines. Come January, Vermont will become the first state in the nation to move to a voluntary, all-payer, accountable care organization model. Vermont is using a grant from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid for the ACO initiative, which will require the same payments for providers treating patients in Medicare, Medicaid, as well as commercial entities. Governor Shumlin's earlier efforts to pass the nation's first single-payer system fell by the wayside in 2014 when it was determined the plan would be too cost-prohibitive. Open enrollment getting underway November 1st for the Affordable Care Act marketplaces, with much hullabaloo over the estimated 25% increase in some regions of the country. States that expanded Medicaid and had a robust competition in the marketplaces have seen far lower rate increases in some cases. Many people are weighing their options of going without insurance coverage altogether during this next round of open enrollment. Many say the penalty, about $700 for a single person, doesn't create enough incentive to adhere to the insurance mandate. Meanwhile, what are Americans most concerned about when it comes to their health care costs? It's drug costs. According to a Kaiser Family Foundation poll, 75% of those polled saw the rising cost of pharmaceuticals as their greatest cause for concern. According to Kaiser's October tracking poll, majorities of Democratic, Republican, and independent voters all support making sure high-cost drugs for chronic conditions are affordable for patients who need them. Ah, the cranberry, the little red berry born of the bug, rich in vitamin C and loads of antioxidants, long held to be one of nature's best little fighters against the urinary tract infection. A study conducted by the Yale School of Medicine found women in a nursing home given high-dose cranberry supplements for a year showed no less incident of urinary tract infections than those not given intervention. Lead author Dr. Manisha Jethani Mehta says it may not be worth the expense of promoting supplements to protect against UTIs. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Neil Shah, founder and executive director of Cost of Care, a global NGO that seeks to help delivery systems provide better care at lower cost. He's the co-author of the highly acclaimed Understanding Value-Based Healthcare. Dr. Shah is an assistant professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive biology at Harvard Medical School, with a practice at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. He's an associate professor at the Ariadne Labs for Health Systems Innovation, where he leads a 50-hospital consortium linking administrative management to clinical performance. He was named as one of Becker's Hospital Review 40 Smartest People in Healthcare. He earned his master's in public policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard and his MD at Brown University. Dr. Shaw, welcome to Conversations in Healthcare.
Thanks so much.
Oh, you learned pretty early in your medical training about the huge variations in healthcare pricing and how medical training did very little to prepare future clinicians for thinking about delivery from the value perspective. And you and a couple of your partners launched Cost of Care in 2009. I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners more about the goals of the organization and how that mission has evolved.
Absolutely. So generally the way medical school works, you spend about a quarter century in a classroom, and then when you're in 25th grade or so, when you're a third-year medical student, they finally let you put on a white coat and touch real patients. And I actually signed up for medical school at a young age at 18. I was at a program at Brown that's like a Brown for Life thing. You sort of do four years of college, and then you go right into med school. Mm-hmm. And my idea of being a doctor was mostly based on what I'd seen on TV. And during your third year of medical school, your job is to kind of walk into every door of the hospital and learn what happens there. For the first time, I got a sense of our fallibility as well. And in particular, I noticed that, you know, in Providence, Rhode Island, where I was in school, they're not the ones with the deep pockets. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that we were making a lot of decisions in a vacuum without really any sense of how our decisions impacted what patients were paying. And the most surprising thing to me was that when you're a third-year medical student, everybody above you seems omniscient. You know, even the fourth-year medical students seem to know everything. And this was the one thing that even the most esteemed professors didn't really have a lot of insight into.
Well, Dr. Shaw, the notion of value-based care, I think, has finally started to really gain some traction in this country. And certainly, I'd give some credit to that, maybe to the policy initiatives in the Affordable Care Act. But you are an OBGYN. You practice within a pioneer ACO. So you've had a pretty firsthand look at some of the real challenges in getting organizations and practitioners to think more about value-based care. What have been some of the greatest challenges so far in shifting the culture?
I mean, I think often when people talk about healthcare reform, they're conflating two things. There's payment reform, and then there's delivery reform. And I think the Affordable Care Act, accountable care organizations, value-based payments, a lot of that has to do with the sort of top-down incentive to think more about value. You know, in 1994, you were still getting AOL CDs sent to you in the mail, and that was the state of the Internet.
Right.
Whereas today, the Internet's very, very different, and every other purchasing decision we make is based on Yelp and Travelocity and other sites that have transparent quality and pricing information. And I think there's a similar expectation that we should be able to do the same in healthcare. At the same time, a lot of patients are facing very high deductibles. So I think, you know, where patients are with this in terms of their expectations around information and transparency is very different. And I think in many ways that's what's pushing not just payment reform, but like delivery reform. And now it's incumbent on us as clinicians to figure out how we fundamentally re-engineer the way we deliver care.
You know, I think there's been a dramatic rise in recent years in the out-of-pocket expenses for many of those Americans covered under the Affordable Care Act. And you noted in Massachusetts, which has had almost about a decade of universal coverage, health expenditures are still a leading cause of personal bankruptcy and financial difficulty for consumers. And so tell our listeners about the solutions that Cost of Care is looking at to incentivize players and payers and providers and consumers alike.
You know, we were 7-8 years ahead of the rest of the country in terms of covering everyone in Massachusetts, but now we're 7 or 8 years ahead in terms of running out of money to pay for it, mm-hmm. which we're much less proud of. And because we didn't have, especially nationally with the Affordable Care Act, it's not like we had a new pot of money. We just sort of spread it around more. And so there's more people in the system, but those people have less good insurance. The average silver plan has deductible that's $3,000-$5,000, which mm-hmm. is real money for most people. Mm-hmm. You know, one CT scan will be a big part of that deductible. So in terms of our work, we've organized our efforts into three areas. We started off primarily as an advocacy organization, trying to build will within the profession, the clinical professions, to consider cost. Because not only was I not taught very much about costs when I was a medical student, but I was actually specifically taught that costs weren't something I should mm-hmm. be thinking about. So what we've done over the years is we've collected now over 500 stories, real stories from patients, clinicians, and healthcare administrators as well, that illustrate these sort of routine opportunities to make care more affordable for patients. And we've disseminated them to well-positioned stakeholders. And in doing that, we've tried to bring attention to all the opportunity there is to improve care around affordability just by making different decisions. But then the clinicians on the ground really didn't have the skills or tools or knowledge that they needed. And then we realized that you can educate clinicians, they can have the will to consider costs, but if you embed them in systems that set them up for failure, you're not doing any good. So we now have an implementation piece of our work, too, that's trying to think about how you design the system around the clinician to help them make better choices.
Well, Dr. Shah, I want to talk about your book, Understanding Value-Based Care. Don Berwick, the president emeritus at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, who we all know for his contributions to patient safety, called this book an instant classic because it offered frontline clinicians a raft of practical ideas to make healthcare dramatically safer. So let's talk about those actionable strategies for individual clinicians or organizations.
You know, the book starts off by trying to help people understand why we are where we are now, including why are healthcare prices so opaque. The second problem is that the prices are arbitrarily determined and often inflated. Clinicians don't feel ownership over that issue because they don't set prices. The third problem, which is the much bigger problem, you know, about a third of the things that we decide to order as clinicians don't measurably improve healthcare outcomes. But we found in our research and in our work that there's actually 10 to 20 other distinct reasons why clinicians do this, which, you know, is much lower hanging fruit than, say, tort reform. And then we get down to really concrete strategies like how to do high-value prescribing, all the way to how to actually design value improvement projects within your delivery system.
We're speaking today with Dr. Neil Shah, founder and executive director of Cost of Care and also co-author of Understanding Value-Based Healthcare. Dr. Shah is a professor at the Ariadne Labs for Health Systems Innovation. And Dr. Shah, you give a great example of how healthcare has gone far off track, and that's the dramatic rise in C-sections performed in this country. And we've had Leah Binder from the Leapfrog Group on the show discussing their transparency campaign regarding hospital C-sections. Tell us the kind of strategies you've deployed in your own practice that might be an example for others.
Over the last 20 years, the patient safety movement has focused so much on the problem of too little that in many cases we've overcorrected. And C-sections is, I think, the perfect example where it's become 500% more common.
Mm-hmm.
And what Leah Binder and others have found, actually, is that one of your biggest risk factors for getting a C-section isn't your own risks or preferences, but it's literally which door you walk through. Mm-hmm. It's like which hospital you go to, especially thinking about realizing that it's something about the hospital that's driving this has been really key. With C-sections, you know, a normal delivery first time, it can easily take 20 hours from when you go into labor to when the baby gets delivered, whereas a C-section takes me 30 minutes. I just did one. And, you know, so there's always a sort of implicit incentive to expedite the process. Emergency medicine physicians face the same sort of thing where they've got a complex patient who comes into the ED. They can either admit, which mm-hmm. is the low resistance pathway, or they can coordinate care and send them back out into the wild. And the strength of the incentive to take the low resistance pathway depends on a lot of factors in the clinical environment, including how the hospital's managed.
Another big opportunity, I guess, is at the level of the practice to make the decisions about ordering tests and prescribing medications. And we've followed with such interest the Choosing Wisely campaign, which was launched a couple of years ago now by the American Board of Internal Medicine Foundation. And their goal is to get providers to think very carefully about the evidence and the need for ordering a test versus the habit and also the overprescription of drugs. Talk about how programs like Choosing Wisely tie into your view of how we can make a difference in scaling back on things which are unnecessary and affecting the cost of care that way.
Absolutely. Choosing Wisely has been tremendous. It's become an international movement in the U.S. I think there's more than 80 specialties now that all have these lists of the five things within their clinical purview that we do routinely but maybe don't have to, you know, including like radiologists and cardiologists and oncologists and other folks who use a lot of expensive healthcare resources are saying, you know, these are five things that we do that we don't need to routinely. And then the other thing that they do is they take the existing evidence for what we should do and they reframe it. The challenge, though, is that there are many things in medicine for which we have excellent evidence, but it doesn't really change practice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's sort of where we are with Choosing Wisely now. We've sort of gotten to a point where we've raised great awareness of these issues, but then there's that second step of closing the gap between what we know we should do and mm-hmm. what we actually do. Mm-hmm. And one of the best examples of this gap, I think, is hand washing. You know, it was an obstetrician 150 years ago figured out that if you wash your hands, you cut mortality in half.
Right.
As we learned during the Ebola outbreak, people are still working on hand washing. Although we're still imperfect at hand washing, we've improved a lot, and we've improved relatively recently by thinking about the barriers to hand washing. The fact that, you know, there was a day actually when I was a medical student where you walk in and suddenly hand sanitizer became a thing, and washing your hands went from a couple-minute operation to being less than a minute. They started to institute 360-degree feedback, so if you don't use the Purell before walking into the patient room, the nurse or the patient probably will call you out on it. So if you were the one spreading MRSA from room to room, it would get really awkward for you very quickly. And then, you know, lo and behold, hand washing got better. It occurred to me when I was a resident, academic medical centers are rampantly overutilizing care. They're the most expensive places to get care in the country. Yet the residents are not really motivated by fee-for-service because they're basically indentured servants. And they're not motivated by medical malpractice because they're relatively protected. There's layers of hierarchy between them and the lawsuit. And yet they still overorder. Often it has to do with other things that can similarly be systematically solved for. It has to do with trying to preempt your future work. So, you know, if you can order 5 tests and not think about it again and occupy a stretcher, that's less good. And so that suggests a very different kind of solution.
Dr. Shaw, you're also associate professor at the Ariadne Labs based in Boston, and it's a Harvard-based research lab linking hospitals around the world to best practices that can improve childbirth and maternity experience. Could you talk about the research you're doing there and who you're partnering with around the world and what you're learning from this consortium?
So Ariadne Labs is a institute was founded by Atul Gawande. It came out of the work that they did with the surgical safety checklist, which, you know, the same way that a pilot has to run a checklist before hitting the throttle, now surgeons have to do the same before picking up the scalpel. And this intervention reduces mortality in half from all surgeries on every continent, basically. So it was
amazing, isn't it?
It was absolutely amazing. I think after the smallpox vaccine, really? I think the WHO thinks it's like the most impactful thing that they did. So there was some thinking about what else, then what are the lessons, especially around not even creating the checklist, but getting to this implementation problem we're just talking about. How do you actually get people to follow it? So this institute grew up around this idea that, you know, quality improvement traditionally is very local, and there's this sense that quality improvement projects don't scale. In fact, if you're trying to do a quality improvement research project, often you don't even need IRB approval because it's assumed that it has no applicability outside your hospital. But the surgical safety checklist sort of proved that. And many other things, medical reconciliation, you know, a lot of these things were truly scalable in ways that made people better. So this is basically a shop that's run by a surgeon, so it's not a diagnosis shop, it's an intervention shop, where the idea is to do this in a variety of healthcare domains. And as an obstetrician, I'm thinking hard about childbirth and the fact that the hospital you go to is your number one risk factor for having major surgery. And so we as part of our work, we created a consortium of 50 hospitals across the country to help us think about what was different from the hospitals that had, you know, that were high performing and low performing, and what are the lessons that we can extract and scale.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Neil Shah, founder of Costs of Care and co-author of Understanding Value-Based Care, published by McGraw-Hill. You can learn more about his work by going to costofcare.org or find them on Twitter at costofcare. Dr. Shah, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thanks so much for having me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Donald Trump claims that a 25% average increase in premiums on the healthcare.gov exchanges announced by the Obama administration was a, quote, phony number. He instead cited increases of 60, 70, 80%. But Trump just as easily could have cherry-picked increases in the single digits. The fact is, the administration's report shows wide variation for the change in premiums. That variation ranges from a 116% average increase for the second lowest cost silver benchmark plan for a 27-year-old in Arizona to a 3% average decrease for those plans in Indiana. There's a mere 2% average increase in the swing state of Ohio, but a 53% average hike in neighboring Pennsylvania. It all adds up to an average 25% increase across the 38 states on healthcare.gov from 2016 to 2017. The median increase is 16%. That's without factoring in government subsidies. But in presidential campaign appearances in Florida, Trump claimed the 25% average increase number was, quote, so wrong, and that, quote, they know that's not true. What is true is that some plans sold on the Affordable Care Act exchanges are expected to go up considerably for 2017. As the October 24th report released by the Department of Health and Human Services shows, there are three states with average increases for benchmark plans above 60%. More states likely have individual insurance plans that go up that high, even though the average increase across all plans is much lower. For instance, the HHS report shows the average increase for the benchmark plan for a 27-year-old in Texas is 18%, but there's wide variation within the state. In Dallas County, the average increase is only 7%, but in Medina County, which includes San Antonio, the jump is nearly a doubling. Tax credits change what many consumers will actually pay. 84% of the 10.4 million Americans with marketplace coverage in the first half of 2016 received tax credits. Those put a cap on the amount an individual must contribute toward benchmark premiums based on income. The wide variation in premium changes among states and different individual circumstances for those buying their own coverage under the Affordable Care Act shows that a nationwide average increase doesn't tell the whole story. But that doesn't mean the number is phony. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Clubfoot is one of the most common childhood deformities in the world, a condition that in the past was not correctable without the intervention of expensive and invasive surgeries. In low-resource parts of the world, access was nearly impossible, and as a result, clubfoot is the leading cause of disability in the developing world.
The effects on the child are devastating. It also has an incredible impact on the mom. These kids have to be taken care of, and often the mother is blamed for having a child with any kind of a problem, as well as having a child with a disability. So devastating for the whole family.
But a breakthrough treatment called the Ponseti method has changed all of that. Cheska Colorado Mansfield was an employee at the University of Iowa where this new, non-invasive, inexpensive intervention was developed, which corrected the problem in a series of months, often before a child even begins to walk.
The healthcare provider gently manipulates the tendons and ligaments in the foot and moves the foot about 10 to 15 degrees and then places the feet in a long leg plaster of Paris cast. That cast stays on for 1 week, and then they repeat the process, and they just gradually move the feet.
She and her colleagues founded Miracle Feet, a nonprofit organization that identifies children throughout the world born with club feet who can be treated for about $250 per child, a tiny fraction of what the surgery would cost. Today, Miracle Feet supports over 100 clinics through partnerships with 25 different partners in 12 different countries. Already having given thousands of children in the developing world the chance to walk, run, play, and to grow into productive adults. Miracle Feet has earned numerous awards for its innovative treatment design and its ability to be easily deployed in low-resource settings.
They have to sleep in a brace at night. The one that we've made is made out of plastic. We came up with a brace that the shoes clip on and off, it's adjustable, the angles are fixed, and we can produce it for $20. So we've essentially come up with a design that enables us to do everything the U.S. brace does, but for a fraction of the cost.
Miracle Feet, providing a low-cost treatment for children born with clubfoot around the world, giving them a chance to live active and fully productive lives. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.